Hi, this is Will. A quick note that my website, learnjango.com, now supports free tutorials and premium courses, meaning my three books, Django for Beginners, APIs, and Professionals, are now available. I'm running a 50% off Black Friday sale until December 1st. More information in the show notes and later on in the show.
Hi. Welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And this week we've got with us Hinnik Twalek, who's Python core contributor and all round, well, you know, I'm a big fan. So hello, Hinnik. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. And I love how everybody has problems to peg me anywhere because I'm so all over the place that it's just this dude in Python and we love him.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. Because I was going to say you're Python core team, but you are on the Python core team, but that's not where you hang out mostly these days, right?
Yeah, I'm not, sadly. Like, my time is finite.
Are you more on the Go side of things, or you're still equally in the Python world, or how would you divide that time?
No. I'm on the Python side.
Okay.
But a vast majority, like, we use Go only when we need something that is faster than Python, which is very rare. Like, Python is fine for us most of the time. Or when we need a single binary, which happens more often when we need a set UID or something like that. But otherwise, it's all Python.
Okay. And so I'm just going to get jumped straight into there because you talk about being faster than Python. Now, there's this whole Python 3.13 and free threading and things like that coming along. Is that going to make a lot of difference? Because I'm quite excited about it. I'm like, this means I can stick with Python. I can do my my template rendering in a thread, and it won't slow down. But what's your view? Because you're a bit more closer to the metal, I think.
I think I'll give you the most senior software engineer answer that there can be. It depends.
So good. We're a minute there, in.
Yeah, because let's be honest, we've been doing pretty fine for like 30 years without free threading, right? So I am absolutely pro free threading. I love it. I'm very excited. I was one of the people advocating for this experiment to start. But you need a parallelizable problem to take advantage of parallelization, right? And people also are not great at writing parallel code, which will probably change because in Python, we do not have good APIs for parallelism with threads because it doesn't make a lot of sense. They are just not great. At some point, you just run into the gill. So nobody ever took the time to like build really good abstractions for free threading. And this is something I'm really excited about when we will build that. But I don't expect any world-changing things happening right now or for most people, but I believe for many people it will be life-changing, like when they have computational things, right? Like the data science people, I think they will be much happier than us. Although their stuff is already usually in Fortran on C and doesn't have to go, so we will see. But it is
okay. And so,
to be clear, it is necessary to future-proof Python. I think that is true. But I don't expect that our code is suddenly going to be super fast or something. It's just, we will see. It will be an evolution. I think it will be more boring than most people think.
Okay, so no instant new world. I was going to ask them, what about the sub-interpreters thing? Because it was all sub-interpreters, and then suddenly free threading came out of the blue, and then I've hardly heard about sub-interpreters for a while.
Yeah, I mean, Eric Snow is still working on them and talking about them, and I think they are also exciting, and I think they are orthogonal to free threading. And I think if they ever reach a certain stage and don't get like the whole all the oxygen pulled out of the room, they can also be very interesting in the future. But they have some limitations, right? Like, you can only exchange certain types of data between sub-interpreters, while you can share anything using threads. Which is both good and bad. So,
which is of course the problem with that.
So there's been this presentation by Yuri Selivanov at last PyCon, where he talked about this amazing. I don't even remember how the proper name for that is, but these are these structures that don't change, but you can change them in a way that they remember the changes. So you're basically applying patches to dictionaries and to lists, and there that makes them frozen, and you can share them across barriers like sub-interpreters. I think the correct name is STMs or something like that. But didn't go anywhere yet. It's still not public. I think it's in their async PG or in their HDB repo somewhere, but you would have to copy it out.
So I guess my one more question in this sort of thread, and then we should cut back to the beginning because we didn't even introduce you or ask anything. We just jumped straight into performance. Is do you think then that these over the medium term, these techniques will keep Python competitive with, you know, the Go's and the Rusts of the world? I mean,
this, two questions, right? What is medium term for you? And Python right now is the most used programming language in the world, right? And the most popular one. So, asking if it's competitive is kind of weird.
But there is this thing at the moment where it's like, if you don't rewrite everything in Rust, the world will end. And I know this, that we have that every time there's a new technology or a new option, but
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, again, I think it's important. It will enable new things, but it is. And I said it before when we were like advocating for these changes, we do not have the fantasy right now or the imagination what we could get out of this because we don't have it, right? We cannot imagine from the primitives that we have now what could be. We will have to do, we have to try it, we have to play with that. And then probably someday out of some company will come some amazing framework that will make everything easier and everything will just fly and everybody will be happy. But I don't think you can expect like there's going to be something in a year or something. There's going to be some nice things. I think async IO works a little bit better when you have free threading and like, things like that. But it will take something big that will add an abstraction that people love to use to be an actual change. But again, it's great for the future, right?
All right, I'll ask a question. So we have a big Google Doc of things we want to discuss, but I wanted to make sure we ask about your day job, which is at Vario Media. I'm probably saying that wrong.
It's not a real word, right? So.
Okay.
But so we are German companies. So we call it Vario Media.
Okay.
Nobody's get offended if you pronounce it English. Yeah, we are a web hosting company. We do email hosting. We are a domain registrar. And we run a kind of tight ship with not a very big technical team, which informs a lot of the things that I do and say. Like, I cannot afford having janky systems that page someone every night or something like that, because that someone is always me. So I cannot just push something to production and hope someone else will have to deal with that. We're only serving the German-speaking market. So that's why probably not a lot of your listeners have heard of us. And our hosting is mostly LAMP. So for the web hosting part.
Like, yeah.
So, yeah. Exciting times right now with WordPress.
Well,
Have you got a hot take on that?
You can't leave us there. Yeah. Is that a model for, you know, the Python and Django worlds, you think? Have a dictator who goes crazy.
What do you mean?
Have a dictator who goes crazy. Yeah.
I mean, Guido was apparently smart enough to just abdicate before he can get crazy, right?
Right. So. It seems like that's the thing, is that Matt had a reputation, deserved or not, for being relatively sane and a, you know, good in quotes person. And so it's...
Yeah, I remember early Mastodon. He was like this, he was kind of celebrated, right? Like he took over Tumblr and integrating things into the Fediverse.
Right. I mean, give it enough time and enough money and power, and I guess this is the lab experiment playing out.
Yeah. Hell hath no fury like a billionaire scorned or something like that.
Right, I know. Well, it's interesting in the Django space for, you know, Wagtail, right, which has been a big thing for a long time, but especially as people are starting finally to think maybe WordPress isn't all it's, you know, maybe we should look beyond WordPress. I'm curious to see if that brings more momentum to things like Wagtail. Carlton, you're making
the thing with WordPress is, yeah. The thing with WordPress is that it's PHP and it's dramatically easier to deploy than anything that will ever be with Python. So you can just drop a bunch of files on a server and it works. And this is why it's so successful. Like you cannot win the war against this one on technical merits, like with feature lists or something. That's just not going to work, I think. I think it's more likely that there's going to be a new open source fork of WordPress.
My sort of experience with it of trying to sell alternatives was always it was about plugins and themes. It was, you know, people didn't care whether it was PHP or Python or Ruby or whatever, but what they cared about was plugins and themes.
Because I didn't know how much of a pain it is to run
right.
application.
Why is my website really slow? Because
I'm curious. Your day job. I mean, clearly it's interesting and challenging to you. Like, what are kind of the things that keep you engaged with it, right? Because you could be doing, we're going to talk about all these open source things that you're doing, but of all the challenges you could take, like this seems to be one that you seem to, you know, enjoy and stick with. I'm just curious if you could talk about running a web hosting kind of company, because that's something a little different than most of our guests are working on.
My open source projects are results of my work at the web hosting company, because I don't do open source just for fun. Like, these are projects that I need, that I use myself, because I don't have time to maintain software that I'm not using. So this is all our stuff that we use. So you can see by that alone that my challenges are quite wide.
Okay, fair enough.
This is probably the reason why I've stayed there for over 20 years, is because thanks to the fact that we are a small team, I have a lot of different jobs in a way. Like, I don't think I could work in a company where I just work on one Django application 8 hours a day. So this is not my life. I have a wide variety. I mean, there's some Go. I write web services. I write async IO code. Like, all our domain registry thing is done in async IO. And works pretty well, actually. So yeah, I wear a lot of hats, and I can kinda sorta decide myself when I change them. So there's a lot of freedom. I mean, there's a lot of pressure and responsibility, because again, if something breaks, it's my fault and I have to fix it myself. But I have a lot of challenges to choose from. And of course, there's this thing that I do, I am the best at the company. There's nobody over me. I cannot get promoted or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So I've hit the ceiling here. So which is why I have this understanding with the company that they let me work on open source projects and engage in this community. That was like literally what I told them. Either you give me opportunity to learn from others there by serving a community, by having exchange with the community, or I will have to go somewhere where I can grow professionally. Well, and
right. Yeah,
here we are.
Yeah,
that kind of autonomy is deeply rewarding, right?
It is. I'm a big fan for like these slow productivity books from Cal Newport and those things, and just like this career capital that you can build up. And it is not that I'm working less. It is just that I work more on things that interest me right in the moment, right? Like, I could take like 2 or 3 weeks off and transfer our projects to UV and just do this deep research of UV. If I don't have a deadline, I have time for R&D, basically.
Yeah.
On the other hand, nobody else is doing the R&D. So this is the other side, right? Like, what I don't do doesn't happen.
Well, that's sort of the dream, right? I mean, Carlton, right? Like, coming off of being a fellow for 5 years, speaking of autonomy, you know, look at what you and Marius are doing. Like, you're not going and being engineer 1,000 at Fang, right? Because it just doesn't translate.
No, so yeah, I'm just working on a single Django app 8 hours a day.
But it's just you. But it's just you, though.
But it's me, and I get to choose it, and I get to set the thing. And I'm it's not a 10-year-old project yet. It's still very much fleshing out. Very much enjoying it. But it is, you know, me driving the direction, and that's the rewarding bit. It's fantastic. You mentioned Cal Newport, Hinnick. I've heard you talk about hustle culture and,
and whatnot. Not a fan, right? Like, neither him nor myself. Like, I mean, there's
treading that balance between doing your thing and promoting it and just being out there sort of slimily selling it all the time.
Yeah, I mean, that's another hustle thing, right? Like, hustle culture can mean different things. Like, the thing I usually talk about is that just do more, do it now, do it as fast as possible. And then there's, of course, this constant hustling and shilling. And I just don't feel good about that. So I don't do that. And
well, it might be that's just performance.
Not great for my success.
Coding or art. Sorry? That's just like performance coding and art, right? If you're spending all your time talking about how hard you're working, how hard are you actually working? Is like, right? It's like when you go up to meetups. When I lived in San Francisco for a while, I tried to go to meetups and they're great at first, but then you realize it's like the same people saying, having the same conversations, and everyone who's actually doing something is like hunkered down doing the work rather than,
bro, I don't even sleep anymore.
You know, I'll say one of the things I found a little disappointing about the Bay Area was realizing that even though everyone was, you know, a lot of people were, you know, nerds in quotes, they were still super all the negative male stereotypes. So it wasn't just like you don't have to be a jock to fulfill some of those. Anyways.
I think we have a name for that.
yeah. Okay. I want to ask one more question. Then I know Carlton has a bunch, but. So I have to bring up, you have a 2011 blog post where you talk about, quote, Django's ORM is still a joke, and reference that you preferred Flask and Pyramid. So I have to ask, I know it's 13 years ago, do you still feel that way, and maybe provide more context around that?
Okay, that quote is very much informed by a bug in Django that, by the way, is still open and can...
yeah, you did link to it.
can legally drink soon. It's not the one that is linked in a post, but...
we'll put it in. It's,
yeah, I have a fun story.
Yeah, 6148.
I have a fun story for you. So, as part of R&D, I was trying out Django to use in our systems, and it ended very, very poorly. Mostly, like, the key reason is that Django is a great framework for greenfield projects, but we do very few of those. We have this existing architecture. The company exists for like 25, 26 years now. We run a weird database, and I had to fight Django a lot more than it was helping me to make it fit our infrastructure. And what happened is that we have a database table that has a composite primary key.
That's nearly coming in.
And I make the long story short, I changed the password of everybody in our company because the table was, the primary key was username and domain. And the ORM never told me that it's only going to have the last primary key you define. So when I set the password hash for a certain user, I changed it for everybody in the company and all of our bots and whatever. So that was a lot of work to fix again.
Yeah.
Yes, I can imagine. I can imagine. When once upon a time, I forgot a where clause on a delete clause that went a delete query that went very wrong for similar
reasons. Well, I didn't forget anything. I just didn't know, and Django didn't tell me. So that.
You know, so that little negative story about Django from times away. By the way, the Google Summer of Code project from this year is going to finally get the composite primary keys moving forward. That's going in, and after, I don't know, 20 years almost, it's
20,
coming,
so 19 no years. The bug is open for 19 years. I checked today.
Exactly. So, but that ties into, you know, a lot of what we're going to go on and talk about is that Django does things a particular way, and it's not necessarily the way you might do it from a kind of pure perspective. So let's just put that out there and then go and talk about your open source work, because you've done so much, and I do want to get onto it and cover it with the listeners. I think the thing you're probably most famous for is the Atters package. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's definitely the one with the most downloads and with the biggest impact on Python itself, yes.
So, I mean, so the Atters, for people who don't know, enables you to define a kind of very very succinct class, and it was the direct inspiration for data classes, which I think most people will have known of.
Yes, that's correct. Like, I mean, headers predates type hints. So that's a thing. There's this funny syntax most people have forgotten about, but people back then really loved, right? The package name is just attr, and the decorator is at etter.s, so headers. And you define attributes by assigning them to etter.ib, like attrib. Hilariously, not everybody got it, and people just imported those symbols, and there was like add s class, and then x equal ip. But yeah, so anyway, this was like the first good class building toolkit for Python, and it was really popular too. And at some point, people started asking to get something like this into the standard library. And I still remember I got the email from Guido when I was at Amsterdam Airport, which is a good coincidence, traveling to PyCon US. And we met up there with Eric Smith and, yeah, did the first planning stage of data classes.
Okay. I mean, it's difficult to get something into Python, right? I mean, like something big like that. It's because normally it's, the talk is always about trimming it down and having less.
Yeah, it's usually not a good idea to put an existing package into the standard library. Like, we have this moniker of saying that packages go to the standard library to die, and it's just literally true.
That's a good one. So we have this same debate in Django, right? So Python was, is batteries included. And I remember when I first picked up Python, I came from the PHP world, I picked up Python, and it was just amazing because, you know, the standard library provided, I don't know, most of the things I wanted. And Django is very much a batteries included web framework, but we have this same tension between keeping things maintainable, keeping them fresh, and being batteries included. Because if you trim everything away, then where do you go? You know, the example I always have is a production web server. I'd love it if there was a production grade web server in the standard library, so I could just sort of import it and create, you know, but I understand why it's not there. But in the same time, I want it because I like that batteries included philosophy. I kind of miss it in a way.
So what many people don't quite understand, and that includes also when we talk about packaging. Like, I made a few videos on packaging, and I get like these comments like, I wish this would be in Python, that it would be done by Python. But there is no such thing as the Python. There's just a bunch of core developers who are developing CPython, myself included, albeit not very active. And they are not necessarily equipped to write a production-ready web server.
Right, web server, yeah, right.
They have no interest in solving packaging problems. I mean, just because you're a Python core developer doesn't mean that you're capable or interested in these kind of problems, right? Like, we cannot just tell them to do that because nobody's paying them to do that. So this is just like a discussion where people just quite understand what they're asking for, because it's not an abstract concept, right? It's not like Mr. Python can reallocate developers to do something different. It's just a bunch of people with own interests.
Yeah, no, entirely. I mean, I guess, do you have any thoughts then on, because this is the other solution, is let's just put everything on pip and then ask people to install it. But the problem then is there's an awful lot of things on PyPI. And how as a newcomer to the community, do you find the right packages, the right resources? How am I ever going to go and find Atus, short of being in the Python community and reading the blogs and hearing it come up? How am I going to discover it?
So many branches that we could take right now. Obviously, they should just listen to your podcast to learn about important things like that.
Yes.
So we've had this the same discussion at a course. Core Summit at PyCon US.
Language Summit?
Language Summit, yes. Sorry. Sorry again. So we've had this topic at a Language Summit a few years ago when I was there too. And it was the question, what kind of things should we put into the standard library and why? And my answer back then was already that we should put things there that make people write better Python, that leads them to a better design. For example, data classes, as much as I'm interested in using headers instead, I understand that data classes are a game changer in making people write classes into just screwing around with dictionaries or, God forbid, name tuples. And this is the things that should be in a standard library, things that lead people to writing good Python. And something I don't want a web server in Python proper, because I want there'd be competing ones. I mean, there's this new one called Granion, which is written in Rust. So there's no way that could be in CPython. And now we're talking about it. If we put a production-ready web server into CPython, as the name says, it would be written in C, which is illegal, as we all know now. And that's not great, right? I don't want a freshly written web server written in C in my standard library. So,
yeah. It was, yeah, I mean, the example came back to me this week. I saw Julia Evans, who does the web comics, the web scenes. And she listed, had a list of points about Go that she liked. And one of those points was that it's got a production-ready web server in it. And it came back to me. I was like, ah, yes, that was something I...
But this is a perfect example, because there is no Mr. Python, but there is absolutely a Google. And Google needs a production-ready web server, so they can just as well put it into the Go standard library and write it in whatever they want to write it, right? So that's the big difference.
Right, that's... Yeah, that's lovely. Okay, brilliant. So swing back to Atas. Can you? So I use Atas all the time. I really like it. I think it's you know, as you say, it lets you define these little classes, and they so then when you're using them, you're not indexing into dictionaries and you're not missing keys. You get type, you know, autocomplete, and you get all the other things. There's one thing that you don't include, and you deliberately don't include it. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk to you about that, and that's validation. Like data validation. Yes. And you've got this line in the docs about how data validation should happen outside your... Could you just explain that, Tate? Because, you know, it's not... There are other opinions, and I'd love to hear you talk on that.
Yeah. So this harks back to ORMs, man. Like, we never finished the topic, so this is great.
No, we're getting to it. We're getting to it.
No. This is perfect. So how do I start this? So yes, address... does not do validation by itself. I mean, it does have validators and these kind of things, but it is not primarily meant to do validation, because I want my data that I've read my business code with, I don't want that to do validation. I don't want to have any information about how the code is coming from or whatever. Like, my core domain model, I want to have pure, such that I can, such that it is in a perfect shape for me to write that business code. And there's been an amazing talk at the last Pike Cascades called The Rising Sea, where the speaker shows how a problem is radically easier to solve if you have proper data model around that. If you first take the step to transform the data that is coming in, and he's using, I think, something from Code Advent, and transform it into something you can work with and then solve the problem. And that makes the code that solves the problem radically, radically simpler and easier to understand and shorter and nicer and everything. And this is where this comes in. Like, I don't mind the existence of Pydantic or whatever, like, is popular right now. But I think it is a problem when we use the same classes we use for validation also for our business logic. And this is the same thing with ORMs. Like, because these are two kinds of design pressure from two sides. Like, the ORM is basically your data model. It's the tables. So your models in your code are going to reflect that fact. I mean, you can probably rename fields and do some joins and whatever, but in the end, this is called table-driven design, because the models that come out of your tables are defined by the table. And in my experience, I mean, maybe I'm weird, but in my experience, you maybe have a say on how these tables look at the beginning, but over time, you lose control over the tables, one way or another. Maybe another team is working on that, or someone else is relying on it. This all should not happen. This is all bad, but it happens all the time. And like, I mean, talk to anybody who's running production code if they can just change the data model. They probably can't. So this is what's coming from database. And validation is the same thing, just from the other side. Like, you probably cannot just change your API, the JSON structures that are coming in, once you've defined them, right? So now you have these two types of design pressure coming from two sides, and in the middle is your business code, and your business code is supposed to be the pure one, the important one. It makes decisions if someone goes to jail or if someone gets married or whatever, right? And this code, in my opinion, should not be affected by how the JSON is looking from the outside because someone decided 5 years ago it should be. So this doesn't mean that, for example, Pydantic is bad. Absolutely not. I mean, people can use it and then transform into the data that they need for their business code. But nobody does that. Like, I've been literally asked from someone, like, usually people ask me, why should I use headers if there's data classes? So this time someone asked me, why should I use data classes if there's Pydantic? And
yeah, right.
This, to me, is an attractive nuisance because you do these two things. Like, you have this data coming from the outside and from the database, and it's extra work to shape them. So you probably are not going to transform it. And you end up with this weird code that is affected by how someone decided 5 years ago how to make the tables and how to make the API. So this is the thought behind that. And this is why I prefer other ways to do validation. And I feel like you need normal classes too at some point. So it's just more layered.
Hi, this is Will again. My website, learnjango.com, is now fully live, and I'm having a Black Friday sale. 50% off all three of my books. With the new site, you get lifetime access and free updates, meaning you'll always have access to the latest version of everything. I've spent almost a year working on it and managing all the user permissions, payments, and the rest. Carlton and I will have a future episode taking a deep dive look into our respective projects this past year. But if you want to support me and the show and get a killer discount, now is a good time to take advantage of the Black Friday sale, which is good through December 1st.
The analogy with the Django projects is exactly right, is that you start off, you've got these nice models, they're really clean, they're tidy, they're expressive, they're quick, and then over time you've got, I've got an extra method here, I've got an extra field here, it does get more complex. And then what people end up doing is creating a kind of a mapping layer to move from the table gateway, which is the Django model, into some more business logic type cleaner models or service layer, or a layer that's decoupled from that narrow ORM.
That is the right points. Way, right? I'm not sure if it's the most common way.
Well, I think a lot of people, there's that tension, right, between
carrying
on and struggling with, or, you know, and it's what's interesting is when do you make this change, or when, at what point is it worth
Because
extra step
it's friction.
Being introduced.
That's what I said, right? It's friction. Like, you have these classes and they almost work. So you either you can make this nice transformation that you just described, or you just make it somehow do, right? If statement here, if statement there, you end up with terrible business code.
That's the same with any growing software project, right? It's not dependent on ORMs or data mapping classes or, you know, everything
not necessarily, you can control the fringes of your code. So I think, like, my job is to deal with whatever is coming from the outside, and I consider the database also the outside, and I can transform it into something I want to use. And the same goes the other way. I this is in my power. I can write some code. And if I don't do that, that's on me. Then I'm just being lazy, and I deserve what I get. But there is no tension if I do it from the beginning. If from the beginning I say, okay, I'm using a validation library that just transforms into normal classes on the one side, and on the other side I use repositories or something like SQLC that spits out normal classes. And then just control those. Because then there's no friction to add it, right? In the other case, you already have something that's almost working, and that adding a little bit of kludges and a little bit of dirty works here and there is the easier way than add a whole layer of transformations. And it's also slower. It's like, it's another indirection.
Yeah, no. Yeah, it's that notion of an attractive nuisance, which I think is the nice metaphor. It's like it pulls you into doing the wrong thing in a way.
I want to ask you about UV and your YouTube channel, but before we switch, you have a number of open source packages. Are there any in particular you want to talk about or call out? I mean, there's too many for us to go through all of them, but are there any that you're particularly interested in or working on at the moment beyond Adders?
If I have, like, my most underappreciated project, I think, is services. For many reasons, and I understand those reasons.
Tell us.
Give us the pitch.
That's the beginning. It's so hard to pitch, like especially to Django people, because you're just used that everything is a global variable somewhere.
You're like animals.
That was not meant at Django. I just have a friend that I have this constant discussion because he does the same thing in other frameworks too, because he's convinced that having singletons in a module is the better way. And actually he says if it's good enough for Django, it's good enough for me. So fair enough. So the thing about services, it is kind of hard to explain in a general way if the person who's listening is not already cognizant of the problem it's trying to solve. I mean, everybody heard of dependency injection at some point in their life, and they probably think it's something with Java and XML. And my second YouTube video was about how dependency injection is actually just passing arguments into callables, and by that way, making things testable. And how you get those things that you pass into those callables, there's different ways to do that. There's dependency injection frameworks that I personally find complicated. And then there's something that's called service location, which is what services is doing. And the big picture is that you have a registry where you define how to create certain objects, as in types. And then you have let's just use Django as an example. Then you would, per Django request, you would have a container which you can use to create those resources, which can be database connections, it can be API clients, it can be anything. And of course, the boon is that at the end, first the container cleans it up behind you, so you don't have to make sure that your API clients are being closed or whatever resource you're using. And you can easily replace those objects for testing. You don't have to monkey patch to replace your database. Which with Django it's a bit more complicated, but there is no an official Django services plugin where also James Bennett is part of. So I'm sure it's pretty good.
Okay. So the two things you mentioned there. One was your video where you introduced this. You talked mainly about dependency injection, but then you mentioned services at the end, and you had a lovely line in there, which just when you said it, I was like, oh yes, it's that. All side effects, anything that can happen, like you write to a file, make a network request, make a database thing, all side effects happen through an object that's passed into the function. And you say, this is the key bit, right? Is that instead of having the database connection card coded in there and you do it, you take that as the reference. And then if you want to pass in a mock or a test fake or whatever, you can do that very easily and test that logic separate to, did it actually make the request or did it actually, you know, without having to do at mock.
I just wanted to quote Brandon Rhodes again, where monkey patching is software bankruptcy, and he's right. I want to say just one more thing.
You said it was underappreciated.
Yeah, and this is like when I talk to people about services and describe what it does, there's two reactions. One reaction is complete blank stare, no idea what I'm talking about. And the other is like this look of pain and recognition. At this point, my estimation is that the average company has like 3.5 implementations of something like services in their company. Just half-assed, because that's literally what they say. Yeah, we've did the same thing, but it's half-assed. So you don't say. And the problem with spreading is that this is very much a project that you, or a package that you use when you start a project. It's a decision that you do when you start something new. It is non-trivial to apply to an existing project. Like even I don't use services in all my work projects. Like I just keep adding it when I get to work on a project or so every now and then. But it is hard to sell because people only need it maybe once per year or something. And the growth is very slow. And again, you have to have this intellectual curiosity to just deal with these kind of things, which most people don't have because they don't care, or I don't know.
Okay. James Bennett, who you mentioned there, he wrote an essay a long time ago about, you know, the Django patterns. And he talks about, he was arguing against using a service layer. It's about, no, lean into the active record notion. And one of his arguments that he gave there was that, you know, people talk about needing a service layer in case you need to change the DB. That's just never going to happen in real life. And so, you know, I'd be interested to get him on again and talk about, you know, how he feels and his development of the Django services layer component.
I mean, I'm not going to tell Django people what to do. And I think James is on the money when he says that if you are working within a framework like Django, you should do as the Django nodes, right? Like it doesn't make a lot of sense to use a fully featured framework like Django and then start using it like Flask. That's not going to go great. I mean, I had to do that basically. That was what I had to do due to my constraints, and it was absolutely no fun. I have replaced at this point zero databases in my applications over the past 20 years. So I don't think that is a good argument at all. But like a service layer, can you use an ORM too, I think? Like it really depends how you exactly define it. For me, a service layer is more defined by the fact that it doesn't do any view things in that sense. And what I'm personally leaning into nowadays is that I'm trying to do something kind of called like a functional DDD. Like it is a lot of inspiration from functional programming where you do a lot of things with immutable data. And it's basically data in, data out, and then you apply the changes, which is even more testable than everything else because it's just data, right? I would not know how to use something like that with a heavy framework like Django. So,
it's difficult to bring in these ideas. You bring them in sort of slowly and, you know, think about them, you know, piece by piece rather than bolt. You know, you can't, there is no one step. Oh, yeah, let's just switch to doing it in a totally different manner. That doesn't exist.
But to me, like a service layer is mostly about controlling transactions and not doing anything with views, which already makes it more testable because you don't have to do view stuff to test things, right? And it's like this separation of layers. And I understand that repositories, for example, are also not very popular in Django for good reasons. But I could just drop words like CQRS or something like that, but we would be here all day.
Yeah, okay. So look, one more thing I wanted to talk to you about in this kind of software engineering world, I guess, is just you've got this fantastic talk and essay combination on subclassing and subclassing in Python. And perhaps you could give us your talk, and then perhaps we could talk, give us your overview of that, and then perhaps we could talk about, you know, a couple of examples from the Django world, because Django uses subclassing very heavily, right? You subclass models to create a model, you subclass the admins to make an admin, you subclass the forms to make a form. So, you know, you probably have views on that. It'd be interesting to just...
I mean, Django is a child of its time, right? So what are you going to do? I've been very involved with the Twisted project, which is from a similar time. I think it's slightly older, but it had the same problems. Like everything is template subclassing, everything is subclassed. And but at some point they realized that, or we. I just have this memory of us sitting in Bristol at a sprint and eating Thai food and watching this seminal talk by Augie Feichler and Nathaniel Manista, and the name was like The End of Object Inheritance and the Beginning of a New Modularity. And it was kind of the talk that in the Python community kicked off the change of thought that maybe we don't have to subclass everything. And I'm not sure where I'm going with that. What I wanted to say is that Django just started at a certain time, so it has certain patterns ingrained. And nobody's going to rewrite the whole thing, right? And it would probably also be weird to just change the paradigm suddenly. I mean, probably would be the right thing, but this is hard, I think. This is really, really hard.
Okay, so let me phrase it. Let me give you something, Guy, because I quite like the subclassing. I think, you know, you subclass a model and it's fine. And I read your essay and I agree with all, you know, I kind of go through and I agree all the points that I think. But, you know, also, you know, if I just take the model and subclass to, if I just take Django's model-based class and then subclass it for my model and I'm not doing crazy inheritance structures, it seems kind of okay, you know, it's like I get all this behavior, I get all the things defined. It's not like I'm losing myself in a million different call chains. And what's so bad? I mean, that's a rhetorical question.
Yes. I mean, obviously, again, it's all trade-offs, right? Like, in a case of models, the subclassing is mostly a mechanical thing to just decide to do it. It could just as well be a class decorator. And the difference between a class decorator and a subclassed approach like this, which I demonstrate in the talk, is you just get everything inherited into your model. So your models are very heavy. And it depends from when that's a problem and when it's not a problem. But you're on a slippery slope either way. And but I don't find that kind of subclassing as bad. And again, we are in Python, so some things only work when you do subclassing. So, but the point I was making in the talk is that we have now two languages, Rust and Go, that have proven that you don't need subclassing as a concept to write great software. You might need subclassing in Python to achieve certain effects, like you have to subclass exception or something like that, like for ontological reasons. And there's different types of subclassing, which I also talk about. For example, specialization is fine. Like Go has specialization. They are just cheating. They call it embedding. It's specialization. It's nothing else. It just works in a very narrow way. And I use subclassing in the same narrow way in my code. But it is something you have to know. Like, it is an active decision. It's active design decision how you deal with those sharp edges. While when you use composition, you have to take effort to break it. You know what I mean? Subclassing is basically broken by design. You get everything in. All the borders are destroyed. You get a lot of things happening by accident and a lot of surprising behaviors. And if you go crazy, like you said, like if you have like this whole hierarchy, diamond shaped, what do I know, right? Then it gets extra hard. So there's many points that you have to take into account. But of course, like just subclassing to achieve a certain effect is not bad. Nobody's going to jail for that. But you have to be cognizant of the rules, and you have to be cognizant on how to deal with the complexity. And you don't have to do that Jesus Christ.
with composition.
Yes. Oh God, sorry.
That's okay. No, so it's probably, I guess, the sort of take home is it's like a cold hygiene thing again. Like, it's another one of these methods of making sure you don't fall into, you know, unmaintained, or making your code harder to maintain in the future as you move forward.
And this is the thing, when someone asks me for advice, I'm going to tell them, if you don't know, don't use subclassing, because it means that you cannot make this decision in an informed way. So
yeah, and you give a good framework.
Yeah. Once you have the knowledge, once you know what Madame Liskov is telling you to do and these kind of things, sure, wield a tool, but it's a much sharper tool than composition.
Okay. It's just one bit on the essay. I agree with the essay as I read through it. There's just one bit of the essay that I do disagree with. Right at the end, you talk about, or you give this example of template method as being the sort of a pattern you really hate. But it's something that, because writing Django web views all the time, they're all the same. You know, they're all CRUD views. 90% of them are CRUD views, and 90% of the operations of the CRUD views are identical. And Django's class-based views are very much template method, right? You override the one little bit you need out of the template in order to make your the particular view that you're working on in that time.
Yeah, sure.
Why do you hate template method so much?
Yeah, I hate them so much because they create this cyclical dependency and this indirection through two classes, and you're jumping up and down the hierarchies, which is like the worst part about making things unreadable. I've just recently written an internal project where I also use template subclassing because the development experience of using the resulting object is much better. So again, it's all a trade-off, right? But I wouldn't build a whole web framework based on template subclassing.
But it's the view. it's the views, right? Where you've got an algorithm which has got some known steps, and those known steps, sometimes you need to plug out a little, well, that's template method, you know.
Yeah, but it probably could have been solved with a strategy pattern or something like that, you know, like it just depends where you're putting in the code, but it's hard to talk about this from thin air.
No, okay. So we've got here in the Google Doc, you get 300 million monthly downloads across all of your software projects.
Yeah, but it's more a function of Python getting incredibly incredibly popular suddenly. Like, I mean, to get into the top 20 of PyPI downloads, you need like more than 300 million downloads. Like, it's insane.
Yeah, that is insane. Okay, go on, Will.
Okay, so two things. We want to talk about UV, and I want to ask about your YouTube channel. So maybe I'll start with that. So your videos are fantastic. I mean, I look at them and I see you're doing a lot of production and you've got quite a few of them. How did you actually get started, I guess would be the question. Because lots of people think, oh yeah, a YouTube channel, but it's quite a lot of work and quite a lot of work to do it well, which I would say you're doing. So what was that journey on, you know, starting your channel and then doing real production? Because again, you're not just one straight take. You've got graphics and cuts and you're doing a really nice job with it.
Yeah, well, thanks for saying that. I mean, I disagree. I think my videos are still terrible, but it's glad that my viewers...
The ones I would do would be way worse, right? I mean, you know, but I think until you've tried to make a video, just seeing even what you've done, I see hours of time in simple things that someone wouldn't if they hadn't done it themselves.
Yeah, you see absolutely correctly. It is so much... I mean, starting the channel was the usual programmer's hubris, just thinking that's how hard can it be? And I'm going to have to tell you the reasons too why I started. Like, reason number one, and that did not work at all, is that I hope to just get better at speaking English because I just get to talk more into the camera. But that doesn't help if you're recording like one video per month because I'm so slow at the production because, as you said, production is really hard.
Sorry, I have to stop you. I mean, your English is almost flawless. I don't really know how much more you would improve to...
thank you for saying that.
I mean, it's true.
But the main reason was really the implosion of conference invitations. Like, giving conference talks was my main creative outlet in my life. Because I cannot draw, I cannot clap on a beat or something like that, but I can give conference talks, and I've been told pretty good ones. And I derived meaning from that too. Like I told you before, small company. So if I want to have an impact to more than 20 people, I have to do something public. And the interaction with the community and the invitations, conferences around the world. I mean, I've been to Japan, I've been to the US, I've been to Russia when it still wasn't that bad. It just stopped in 2019. And whenever I talk to conference organizers, everybody's just complaining how they are just out of money. So basically this whole bubble just burst for me. And my other creative outlet, which is writing, has also kind of tanked because whatever Twitter and Google are doing there right now, like everybody who has a blog will tell you, unless you are not on Hacker News front page, nobody reads this stuff anymore. So I decided to go where the people are, and YouTube is apparently the second biggest search engine in the world nowadays, probably after TikTok, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And I thought you were going to say Google, but yeah.
There is some logical synergies with conference speaking, right? Because I'm doing like this talking head video stuff, which is basically giving a talk. I had a photography side business many years ago until I realized that having a photography side business means looking into Photoshop after work, which I did not enjoy at all after a while. But I kind of understand how lighting works. So, and it still took me way too long to figure out how to record in my tiny room here. But yeah, I'm getting somewhere now.
Right. Well, it's all about the, you know, the key lamp and then the overhead and then the side one. You've got the shadows working. Like, I mean, I can tell because I've like, yeah, it's not so easy to do.
Yeah, basically I have one big light on the right, top right, a small light to the left, which is basically just like a lamp. I mean, that is for webcams, but I just rotate it into me talking to it. And I have a silver fill disc under my chin because I have deep set eyes. And Yeah, I record using my iPhone to an SSD.
Oh, do you use a
microphone?
Cameo or what's
come
it,
again, please?
What's it called? Is it Cameo or the software for using your iPhone? It's with a C.
No. I record directly on the phone. Like the new iPhones, they have like this raw and log recording, so very high quality.
Oh.
But it's very big files. So I'm recording directly to SSDs on that. So I connected SSD to it. There's like this crazy contraption that I connect to my phone, which is also like leading out an HDMI to my iPad. So I see what I'm doing because it's right next to a wall because this room is tiny. But I record audio directly to my computer. And this shouldn't have taken more than one afternoon, but it took me weeks of experimentation. And Lukas Schlanger was helping me a lot, especially with the audio and everything. And it's a process, yeah. But learning about it...
I'm sorry to interrupt. I was going to ask what video editing software are you using?
So I started using DaVinci Resolve, which is free. But I did not quite warm up to it. So I switched to Final Cut Pro, which is like this Apple software. And I'm really good with Keynote, which, by the way, I'm using for the slidey stuff in my videos. So I felt more at home because DaVinci Resolve really feels like a Linux application, which it is. And like in the best and worst possible way, it's like super powerful. But I just couldn't get really happy with that. Like, so I switched to Final Cut Pro after, like, I think, up with my third video or something like that. So yeah, this is also very expensive, by the way. So Final Cut Pro, $300. Then you spend even more money on the plugins and everything, right? So yeah, I couldn't be doing this without my GitHub sponsors. So, and since I'm talking to one right now, so thanks for your support.
Well, I think you know you're right about
that. No problem. Thank you for turning out all the great stuff.
Yeah, the conference talks. I mean, our friend Jeff Triplett has just launched Django TV to try to put more light on conference talks. But conference talks, even though they're available on YouTube, you look at the viewing numbers. It's a couple hundred, maybe a couple thousand max. Whereas, I mean, your video
on my subclassing talk has 5,000. Like I think this is my best talk I've ever given, like in every way. The subclassing one, and that's 5,000 views, and so it's like nothing, right?
Yeah, I know.
Like the UV one had 20,000.
Right. Yeah. Well. Okay. Well, I know we're coming up on time. We have to ask about UV. I would ask you a million questions about YouTube, but so UV, right? So you have, I think, two main videos, right? Like one asking, is it the answer? And then a second one saying it is the answer. But what I was really impressed by is you really go in depth. I think they're both about 20 minutes. And, so give us the pitch, right? But I was really impressed. You could easily have done just a quick clickbait, short thing. But you really dove into why it's so great, but also how it could be improved going forward. So you stand by... I guess as a question, you stand by the most recent video, you're still on the UV train and you think this is the packaging answer we've been looking for in Python?
Yeah, definitely. It is not like nothing before. So yeah, so for the foreseeable future, I think it is the future of Python packaging. So you want to give me a pitch for my videos or for UV?
Oh,
I wasn't quite sure what you were asking for.
Oh yeah, I guess I do this sometimes. I just, Carlton... knows I just talk. I guess I was just saying people should watch the videos, but I was giving you a compliment that they're really in depth, so people should go watch them. You can't sum them up neatly, but I was, far more in depth than the usual videos, right? If I see something on a topic I'm interested on, usually it's someone just saying, this is interesting. But you, I guess we don't have time to dive into all the nuance that you cover, but you do a good job with it.
Yeah, it's mostly a result of lived experience. I'm not talking about things that I've read up somewhere, but I've been part of all this shenanigans around Python packaging, and I've been around for a long time. So I remember when setup tools finally got freed and was taken over by the community, and when it was a big deal. I remember when Wheels came to life, mm-hmm. and it stopped being a big deal to install a binary extension.
Yeah.
So I've of course, that's a gift of age, I guess. So I have the perspective and the context to talk about these things in this way. And just knowing so many of those problems that they are actually solving. And I have the humility to say that they are not really solving my problems. Like, I was reasonably happy before. Like, PDM worked great for me. UV is much faster, but I can see how important UV is for the Python community. Because, again, at a community-wide scope, I don't care about the speed at all. So, which also, like, there's been this NPM blog post about why NPM should not be rewritten in faster languages. And I think this is a red herring. Like, if UV would be just as slow as PDM or PIP, it still would be a huge deal, because people complained about Python packaging being unclear and janky. Things were broken, and it was unclear what tool to use when. There was a bunch of 90% solutions, like, and you have to know where your 100% are in that spectrum, so to use the right tool. These are the things that people are complaining about, not that PIP is too slow. That was never an issue, at least not on a serious thing, right? And I don't think this is possible to achieve in Python. Like, we've tried, and Hatch came close, but only by using Rust helpers again. Like, Ulfek wrote this PyApp thing. So some Rust or Zig or C is inevitable, but don't use C. C is illegal now, at least in the US. We all know that. But now, modularizing it would make things more complicated again, right? And you cannot ship like a packaging tool that has a binary extension. That would just make it. That would make things worse, not better. So.
So you think it's the one tool thing that's the real?
Is the one tool that doesn't break. That is my main point. And I think that also resonated most with the audience of my video when I'm making this point. And I, of course, don't want UV to be the only tool, right? I want PDM to exist and do well. I'm happy to keep PIP the default installer, and so people can use it if they want to. I don't want to convince anyone to use UV. It's fine. Just use whatever you want, right? But I'm really glad that we've just solved the biggest Python problem we've had, rivaled only by the GIL. But I think this is a bigger deal than the GIL, because people run only months later to using Python into threading problems. But the initial impression of installing Python, of using Python, of installing an application, of starting an application, that is something that you have on day one. And that's a huge difference. And people are like looking for hair in the soup, which, as a Czech living in Germany, to very complaint-heavy countries, I fully understand. And we also totally need to do risk management. Like, we need to plan for when Astral's VC overlords will pull the rug under us. But I wish the conversation were more solution-oriented and not less like pearl-clutchy. Like, yeah, there are bad aspects to this. Like, this is absolutely true. But also, this is something wonderful that we've been waiting for. We've been begging people to use money to solve this problem, and now someone did. So now it's our job, basically, to make the best out of that.
I just had one question on it, which I saw a post this week from Nolan Lawson. But he was talking about he was saying why he's skeptical of rewriting JavaScript tools in faster languages.
Yeah, that's the one I meant.
The same post you're referring to. Yeah, but the point I took from that I thought was quite good was that the thing with when a tool's written in Python, or in his case, JavaScript, users can sort of debug it themselves. When they hit a problem, they can get in, they can understand the what's going on. But if it's written in another language, a compiled language, suddenly that ability to dig into it is gone. And I wonder if that's a loss.
So I'm going to say the word again. It's a trade-off. It absolutely is a loss. There was this really interesting Mastodon thread started by Jacobian, by your very Jacobian, where he kind of shitposted, kind of lamented the fact that you used to have to learn C to contribute to Python, then you stopped having to learn C to contribute to Python, and now you need to learn Rust. And that absolutely is a loss. But the question is, what are we getting for that? And I have to say I have not debugged PDM or pip many times. So for me, this has not been a loss in a practical sense. And if it helps all those people that have been so frustrated by Python in the past, and by the way, many of those are in the comments of my video. It's not even funny. Like how many people are just airing their grievances with Python packaging. So there's so much pain that still needs to get out. So those people are there and this is helping them. Like they are the ones where we say, this is the one tool, use it. And at some point you can still look at other tools. But for now, with this one, you don't even know, you don't even need to go to python.org. You just download this one thing.
Well, okay. I think we're out of time. We could still talk about so many things, but I feel like this is a...
This wasn't even half of my notes, man. Like,
I know. Well, we'll have to have you on again if you'll come.
Well, yeah. And absolutely. You know, thanks so much for indulging all our silly little questions about this and the other. But it's good to be able to pick your brain and get your responses.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to my rambling. I'm used to script everything out because, of course, English is my third language, so it's very hard for me to just have coherent thoughts live.
Yeah.
So, which is...
Well, we have links.
So nice to lie to me all the time.
No, it's...
I'm not sure I could have... So I speak Spanish and Catalan, so I live in Spain. I'm not sure I could have an in-depth technical conversation about ad hoc, about software engineering in Spanish or in Catalan. I'd struggle. So I think you do phenomenally.
Thank you. And the funny thing is I have a much harder time to speak about technical stuff in German or Czech because it's just not...
Because it's not the language of... Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Okay. Well, we have links to all these things. Definitely check out YouTube channel, personal site. And again, thank you so much for coming on. We are at djangochat.com and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This show was brought to you by learnjango.com. Free tutorials and premium courses to help you level up and stay informed of all the latest best practices building websites with Python and Django.